This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Justin Cherno. We'll talk to Justin about punk and noise rock, natural wine, and of course, the Four Horsemen. We'll taste a wine for our weekly wine sip that Justin forgot to tell me, so he's going to pull that out towards the end of the show. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. From Youngstown, Ohio to Brooklyn with a stop in D.C., Justin Cherno was on the music scene in D.C. in the early 90s with his band Pitch Blend, later Touring Machine, and other bands. He eventually settled in Brooklyn and was at the forefront of natural wine, working at retailer Uva, you'll tell me in a second, and natty wine distributor Zevero Vine. Selections. Justin is now a partner and wine director at the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg with his partners, LCD Sound System frontman James Murphy, Christina Topso, Randy Moon, along with his Michelin-starred chef, Nick Curatola. So the question is, what is a punk rocker by way of Ohio and D.C. doing at one of the most respected restaurants and natural wine bars in the country? We're going to find that out, all right? All right, welcome back to the Grape Nation, Justin. We were talking offline that you were on the show, I think it was like five, six years ago,
I think.
Yeah, and you were one of our early, you know, Grape Nation guests, and you were just getting this thing going, and one of the common things is it was the first raw wine, and, you know, that was all going on. So it's nice to have you back. I think you and I spent some time this past summer with Patrick, which was very cool. Zev was there too.
Yeah, it was fun.
Which was kind of nice. We are taping the show at the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg. And I'm talking to Justin in person, and we're in the back room. What do we call this again?
This is Night Moves. This is our nightclub bar. Wine and cocktails, just hang out.
So I'm staring at vintage Macintosh. I'm staring at custom speakers everywhere, and I'm staring at a very cool room and a turntable across the way. So let's get started. All right. I don't want to spend too much time on your past because we may have covered that. But I'm just curious about a few like click points. When did you leave Ohio? Why did you wind up in D.C.? And tell me, just weave in how the music thing became. Like, was your dad a pianist? And he said, you got to take – tell me that story.
I'll go through each of those points, I guess. So I moved from Ohio to D.C. in 1989. Like most 19-year-olds, I moved there for, like, a relationship. I was dating somebody. I was dating this girl. She saw – I think her.
Wait, so it wasn't a family move?
Oh, absolutely not.
This was you. That's pretty young.
Yeah, I was young. I know. It didn't seem young.
And it doesn't now, but it's not traditional.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, I was a 19-year-old living with his girlfriend in Washington, D.C. She moved. She ended up getting a government job out of college.
Alas, D.C.?
Yeah, Alas, D.C.
Okay.
And so I ended up moving. So I sort of went to visit, and I got there, and I thought to myself, wow, this is in Ohio. And I was ready. I was pretty much ready to get out, and I had been playing in, you know, small local bands and having fun, and, you know, had a community. It was an interesting place in the 90s or 80s. There was a lot of music in Northeast Ohio and Western Pennsylvania, so I spent a lot of time in Cleveland and Pittsburgh, and I had a lot of friends from those places. And I thought, best case scenario for my life, if everything went really well, maybe one day I'd live in Pittsburgh. You know, maybe. That was the big city to me.
That was,
you know,
lofty then.
Yeah. So I ended up moving to D.C., and I was very lucky to it's right after moving there very quickly, I got a job at a record store, like, with no experience. I'd never even had a job. and got hired right away, and they needed somebody. I think somebody quit or something like that, and I started working. It was books upstairs, records downstairs. It was a really fun place, and I met a lot of people.
But because you were a musician, was it a cool thing to be at a record store?
That was exactly just, what I wanted to do. Because
it wasn't
also,
just a job.
No,
it was
a cool job. Because also that's where the people that I wanted to know worked. So I made a lot of friends there and started playing music there. And so then after a few years there, it was time to go. Leave DC gets pretty small, especially then. It was a much different city then. And I really wanted to live in New York.
And but so, were you doing a band in DC? Was Pitch Blend
yeah,
DC?
Yeah, Pitch Blend was a Washington, D.C. band.
But don't gloss over that. I mean, I'm that sorry, was
yeah,
a fairly...
It was a small band. It was like a little band.
But I mean, you got some critical acclaim and you played.
Yeah. Well, there were. It's like just like we're going to talk about with wine, there was less stuff in the market, so it was easier to get more attention then.
Okay.
You know? And
still,
So yeah, so we did okay. We toured, did things like that, and put out records, and it was fun. And then...
Describe the music.
I mean, it was angular... semi-confrontational, art-rocky, post-Sonic Youth-y kind of stuff. But that was like the music. It was indie rock. It was the kind of music we loved. And we had a nice contemporary base of other friends and bands. And we got to spend a lot of time, make a lot of like-minded friends. And that also made moving somewhere like this a little easier because because of traveling, we already knew some people up here. So when I moved up here, one of my closest friends who played bass in the band, he also moved up here around the same time with his girlfriend. And so we've maintained a lot of those friendships, even from the 90s, still really close.
So when you moved here, do you move here with the idea that you'll pursue and continue the music thing, or you just came here and then you'd see what would happen?
No, I was 24.
Focus?
I was 24 and I'd already been in that band for 4 or 5 years and we had all done our thing. And, you know, it was time. Everybody was ready to sort of like, you know, you kind of run your course. You make 4 records in 5 years and stuff. Everybody still wanted to play music, but I wanted to, you know, move here and have other opportunities. We all grew. And so I was interested in playing with other people and things like that. So I came here and it took time, but then I ended up starting that band Touring Machine with the bass player from Pitch Blend and our friend.
So Touring Machine, reference to Alan Turing.
Alan Turing, yeah.
Kind of heady.
It's like an instrumental, like technical band. And then we did a small amount of touring, put out a couple of records, and, you know, New York always gets, I think, you know, New York got more in the way of that. I mean, we did pretty well and we had a blast.
So I was going to ask, did you make a living from the band or you needed
I've never
a
made
day
a living.
Job?
I've never made a living from any band I've ever been in unless, you know, never made a living from any band I've ever been in. It's
that
just
clears
not, it's just
everything.
Not,
yeah,
not okay. at all. But I was willing to. I was willing to have the jobs that I needed to have in order to make that living, and it was fun, you know?
Were those, would you say Pitch Blend and Touring Machine were the two most prominent?
Yeah, for
as
sure.
As far as, because you did a few other things.
Yeah, I did other stuff and played in other bands and things like that, but it's funny because, you know, I was in bands from, say, 16 to 36, and I've done Wine from 32 to 51. So I've actually done Wine as almost as long.
That's right.
And much more committedly and much more successfully than I ever did music.
Well, I want to talk about that transition.
Yeah.
But when did you realize the music thing had to become like a full-time real thing, like a job or something?
Well, I mean, yeah, the whole time you hope it becomes your job. You never pray that it's the only thing. You know, you're in the arts trying to just have one job and have one thing to do, and that's wake up and play your guitar every day and travel around the world. And that's, you know, and just even getting to do it a little bit, I did it more than a lot of people
I mean,
and so, but you know, I was being surrounded by people, like having seen bands with like actual real success, and seeing people in music really go into points in their life where like, this is my full-time job. But there's something I was talking about with my wife about this a while ago. It's funny. Most of the people I know that became pretty successful in music weren't really capable to think of anything besides maybe like the first half of tomorrow, but they couldn't really see into the future. So I know a lot of people that put all their chips on my band and did pretty well and put out some records and even sold 20, 30, 40, 50,000 records.
Wow.
Then they hit 35.
Right.
Nobody, you know what I mean? And then they were like, uh-oh. Like, you know, the New York I moved to in 1994, you could work at the Strand and pay your rent and live alone.
Right. Different.
You could work at Kim's on St. Mark's and have a roommate and live one block from the train. You could go out to Dojo to dinner and like go to, you know, get falafels and all that. Those that world of like, and you didn't secretly find out every one of these people had rich parents. These were like working class people that moved here that wanted to make stuff.
They made
and, like,
their own ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't, I again, I'm disconnected from a lot of that, but I don't know if a lot of that exists anymore.
I don't think so.
And it was a different thing, you know?
I don't think so. I think, you know, that's a time, I don't want to say bygone era, but that's the way it was then. And it's a lot different now,
yeah,
period.
It is.
All right. So tell me, because we alluded to it before. You just said that half your life's been music, half has been wine. Mm-hmm. The current half has been wine. I can't figure out that transition when you realized wine was something that, for lack of better words, fell for and started moving towards it and got seriously. When was that? Who was it?
I mean, it was probably like when I started working at UVA in the 2000s.
But back, mm-hmm, yeah. Was that because that was a job or was the mindset, hey, this is a cool place, I think.
I think one thing you have to understand is like, you don't have to just like one thing, right?
Right.
So I didn't just, it wasn't like I either liked music or I was really into knitting. Like I could be a musician and love wine and love restaurants and love reading, you know, literature and things like that.
But why wine and not knitting?
Exactly. Because, well, you got to get drunk.
Okay.
One, I loved being around the table, love late nights, love eccentrics, love weirdos.
So what wine does, that whole community.
And like the when I started to meet the community of people that were interested in the wines that I was interested in, I started to see similarities. And when I started to travel, I also met a lot of winemakers that were in bands when they were teenagers or in their 20s. There are a lot of natural wine people, and it's probably the same thing for conventional wine. I just don't travel to these places, so I don't know these people. But I've met tons of people that were like, oh, I heard your band. I was in a band like that in you know, Beer Eats or whatever. Like, like there were, and it's not just like, you know, there were a lot of people who came up in countercultural, kind of like strange little niche culture things, and they found their way to agriculture. I mean, there is a thing here that happened on the East Coast, which is, you know, in the last 20 years where people left the cities and moved to make goat cheese and, you know, started doing farms and what much more thoughtful kind of farming and raising animals in a different way. And a lot of those people did come from my subculture. And so I think that, you know,
same mindset.
Yeah. It's a similar mindset. I mean, I always said that about, you know, wine. I did this wine class, it was like 9 years ago and it was for actually a music festival, and it was part of the music festival. And I talked about how one thing that really clicked for me when I was young, and I've said this before, but it was like, I realized that like, I couldn't figure out how to remember wines. And my friend Jay Sterell, who's actually the publicist for our restaurant, but one of my oldest friends, we lived in a group house together in DC. That's how I know him. And he's really the main person that was responsible for getting me into wine. He hired me at UVA. He got me hired at UVA. He always had bottles around. He knew how to operate in this world.
Did he bag the political thing then? And
he was still kind of around. It was like a little bit in the middle of both. Yeah. But you know, he was much more comfortable in a restaurant than I was at the time.
Right.
And so the thing was that, I realized that, you know, I couldn't figure all this out, but I was like, I could remember. We can go to a record store and I could remember every record I looked at. I could hear a song and find, you know who the producer was, know when it was, what studio they did it, and what guitars they used. Like all that stuff stuck in my head. And then I figured out this little algorithm in my head, which was that the winemaker was the band. The vintage was like when the record was released. The name of the cuvée was the song. And, you know, and the distributor was a record label.
That's perfect.
And
right.
And then, but it was like immediately when I realized that, then it all worked. And I've said this before. And like,
that's
that was
a very
really the
cool,
basis. It was the basis of that class. And I've actually seen other people write about coming into something like that in their lives. And it was just like, that's how the filing cabinet in my brain works. And then I remembered everything. And then I was able to be that. That's when I became a good wine buyer, and that's when I started being at a table and remembering the wines I had, rather than being like, "Cote de Rhone's pretty good. I don't know who made it." You know what I mean?
Like, right, right, right.
That was like a real transition for me. And being able to file that stuff in my head is something I had such a lifelong obsession with. I think it put it on a level playing field. And I really enjoyed it the way I enjoyed music. And I really enjoyed meeting the people that sold the wine to me and distributed
it. So you were at UVA, what, 8, 9, 7, 8, 9 years?
02 to 12, so 10 years.
I mean, that's a long time. It was a long time. So obviously it fed your desires. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you said you were traveling because of UVA. Yeah. I guess people would come in.
Sure. You meet people and you'd realize that, like, you know, the world was smaller than you thought. Because even after all the traveling I did in bands, I never went to Europe before that in bands until much later.
I don't think you would do a gig in like the Loire Valley so quickly.
No, exactly. Right? Yeah.
You know. So let's talk about UVA. Let's talk about Zevrovine. You'll put those two things together.
Yeah.
When you got to UVA, were you eventually the wine buyer? I mean,
eventually, yeah. At first I was like, you know, Tuesday and Thursdays, 5:30 to 10. And I was working multiple jobs at that point.
I hope after 10 years you got a promotion. Yeah, I
think I was only there for like two. I think I'd only been there for 2 years before I got made the buyer, which was pretty great. But there was a small.
What was it? Leaning towards smaller producers, was that set in when you got there?
For sure.
Is that something that caught your attention?
I think we talked about this too last time I was on, but like what essentially happened was the buyer there, Shane Smith, who now has his own distribution company called Rough Mix, he was a very, very early enthusiastic evangelical level buyer from Dresdner, especially Jenny Francois, big time Jenny Francois supporter, and you know, wherever he could get his hands on these wines. And he really believed it. I mean, like the after party for their trade tasting would be at his apartment. Like he was really, he was
tied in.
Customer number one for them. And so when he left, he recommended that I get the position. And then it was my own journey to start buying those wines. I wasn't a big fan. I thought a lot of them tasted exactly the same there. I didn't like Brett. I didn't like VA. I might not have even known what a lot of those things were then, but I knew I didn't like those tastes. And then over time, tasting with sales reps and learning over the next year being there, I started to find my own voice, and it turned out that the wines that I really liked that I was being shown by sales reps happened to be lower intervention, no sulfur, all, you know, like things that fell into the natural wine category at the time. Even Kermit wines, you know, things like that, like a lot of stuff.
This may be a silly question, almost like clueless, but are the wines better now than they were then? I mean, natural wine's been around a while, so a lot of these guys have been making it. But a lot of the complaints, which weren't necessarily true, mousy and consistent, all that.
I mean, it depends. There's still, you know, the thing is, like, if you fall in love with something that changes every year, and as much as, like, you know, you've seen
vintage.
Exactly. Vintage changes. Unless the wine's supposed to be different every year.
A Napa cab.
And what's happening now, you know, with climate change and like really just a bunch of horrible growing seasons in a row. Some wines are good. So it just depends. I mean, people still end up with a mousy Cuvée. You know what I mean?
It's just a silly question because the circumstance then is sort of the same now.
You always have to taste. Yeah. And this is like a whole other thing. But like now that, you know, when Horseman opened, we were one of a few places doing what we did. The Ten Bells had been here for a long time. People had definitely done natural Lee Campbell, Byron Bates, Jorge, Fifi, people had done natural wine lists previously in the city, but there was a period of time where they could get what they wanted and taste everything and make sure that the wines they had were of quality. Now there's every new place that opens has these wines and people ask for them. And that's a finite thing because growers don't make that much more wine. And it's now around the world, people want it, you know. And so now we can't taste these wines.
Right.
Nobody shows up with a bottle a lot of the time to say, hey, this is the new vintage from blah,
blah,
blah. Sucks
for you.
You get an email.
Because you knew it, you get it.
Do you want your wine?
And but I you say, don't know, you I? Don't miss what yeah. you know.
Well, if you ask to taste it, then it all sells. And so you missed your chance to get it, and you didn't get to taste it. So you have to really roll the dice a lot of the time.
So that's now, and I totally understand. Yeah, yeah. But then we're – the consumers walking in the store when you went out, were they receptive to these wines? I mean, I think people would go to an UVA as they would now and say, hey, this is what I like. Tell me what I should drink.
The amount of wine that came back. I remember a lot of wine came back.
So the recommendation
a lot of wine
was
would come
up,
back.
But well, the taste sent it back.
People would come back and they'd be like, that wine you wanted me to drink is fizzy. the thing you get, I don't understand what this taste is.
Well,
but, you know, and like we didn't know what the taste was either. We just thought it was good, you know. The amount of Jura wine that was returned specifically.
More than any
other. More than any other wine. But, you know, people used to bring back Pacalay. People used to bring back Medio Pepe. People, like, these are top quality growers, you know, producers. They were confused by a lot of the stuff. And we didn't know what the hell we were talking about.
That's crazy.
Because we had never had Jevry Chambertin from somebody else. We had never had Sancerre from somebody besides Sebastian Riffaut. Like, we thought that these were wines that we loved. And somebody who knew just a little more than us would be like, I got news for you. This is not what this is supposed to taste like. Or you know what I mean?
Really? Oh, sometimes, okay. So bared itself
but
out.
It was a long time ago. It's like, it's...
That's great.
I actually like a world more where people aren't afraid to tell you that they hate something rather than being afraid to tell you that being afraid that if they tell you they don't like it, you don't think they're cool or you don't
I
think they're smart.
You.
We used to call this the free jazz quandary when I was in music. The idea that like... If you didn't like something like really avant-garde.
Like if Don Cherry's blowing away. Well, if everybody's like, that's cool.
If you were like, you know, I just really don't like this. They'd be like, oh, don't worry. One day you'll be smart and you'll like this. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like, so, and I, that's like, I prefer people being like, I actually think this is garbage and I don't want to, you know, as much as I love free jazz.
That's
so,
an interesting point. Back then, I mean, was most of the wine from France, was it mostly Jura?
I would say most of the growers that were taking the chance in these
made
wines, like LD, like Dresner at the time, and Jenny and Kermit, they were mostly focused in France,
right?
And that seemed to be where the heartbeat of the wines were at the time.
And you spent time in France, Paris,
wine bars, all that stuff. Yeah, I did the usual
big
thing.
Proponents
yeah, and you know,
getting those
just
wines
in,
out there.
Maybe within the last 6 or 7 years, have you started to see wine in even in Paris? That's not from Paris, or not from France. I mean,
right?
You used to go out and you'd be like, maybe you'd see an Italian wine, but it was always an orange one. Like if they had one, it'd be like, skin macerated wine from Prinsic or somebody like that, you know.
Is orange wine still a thing? You're running this place. Do people come in so narrow sighted and go, I want orange wine.
I'm sure you hear this and you see this, but for me, it is its own.
When I say it's still
own,
a
yeah,
thing,
it's its
we
own,
knew what it's it was,
own,
what it is,
own,
what it
it's
will
its
be.
Own beverage category. And the only thing I could relate it to is what it was like to sell rosé in the mid-2000s. People would come in, you know, we used to have a joke, between Memorial Day and Labor Day, we had a crew of customers that would come into the wine store, and you couldn't get them. We had a rosé table of like 30 rosés. They never looked past that table. And the minute Labor Day hit, you didn't see them again until Memorial Day. Now you have a 365-day-a-year orange wine customer. But you do see guests sit down and somebody gets a glass of something that's cloudy and, you know, dark amber. And they're like, that's what I want. And that's what they get. And, you know, thankfully there are a bunch of great – there is a, you know, amazing tradition of these wines. And there are great skin contact wines.
So,
and there's a lot available.
While I have you.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to do a show on orange wine.
That's good.
But – recommend one or two producers that are good, you would serve, somewhat accessible.
I mean, Prinsic for sure.
Spell.
Prinsic.
Okay.
Daria. I mean, phenomenal wines.
Okay.
Like, you know, part of that sort of disciples of Grosvenor-y kind
right,
of world,
right, right.
You know, like, but where there's a tradition of that kind of winemaking, I think those wines are really.
Give me one more.
Fantastic. For something else, I would say, like, you know, I really love the wines from Slobodne. Those are
the producer,
yeah,
Slobodne?
They're like, I like Central Europe as a whole.
Yeah,
you're really seeing some really beautiful wines from that part of the world, and people that where there is a tradition of skin contact and of low sulfur and things like that. You know, because just for the sake of, you know, the expense, people did a lot of low intervention wines because you just didn't buy the other chemicals and products that you needed.
Right.
But Central Europe as a whole, I've been really lucky to go for the last few years to Austria and then some surrounding regions with groups of other colleagues from around the world.
Yeah.
On a trip around this wine fair called Charakter that's in Vienna, which is a really incredible wine fair. And it's really about putting these, you know, this sort of group of people together to be group of buyers and even, you know, journalists and people, and they take us to different growers and we learn
I was just talking. Really, do you know Marco Kovac?
That's who puts on the fair.
That's what I'm saying. Marco's a good friend. I was talking to him, and
yeah, Marco's a dear friend of mine. Yeah, and it's really funny.
And Jay actually hooked me up with him. There we're trying to do something. So no, there's very interesting.
But I mean, stuff. I feel like that part of the world as a whole, like, you can't really go wrong.
Yeah, I agree, and I think you should be more open. It's not one or two producers.
Yeah. So I think you should. Yeah, I think it's more about, like, also, just everything's so culty now. Like, just, like, get into a region. Like, go where you can get the wine.
All right. So, good lead into what I was going to ask you at some point. When you say culty, so is that the effects of social media on this? I mean,
undeniably. 1,000,000%.
It's like, why would this be culty if nobody knew about it? They're seeing pictures of the orange in the glass. They're at a hip bar.
People do. No, I mean, people just hold up their phone and say, do you have this?
Is that negative, positive, neutral? I mean,
I don't know. The problem becomes, for me, the problem becomes when it's so influencer based that everybody wants the same 30 wines, and then those wines become very hard to get. And now I never in my life thought I would see Jura wines for over $1,000 a bottle, retail and restaurant list, and now I see them.
What's a good example of that? I mean, I should know, but
Kenjiro Kagami, Domaine de Miroir, and Rotalier.
Well, that's kind of rare stuff anyway. But
they're rare, but
still, $1,000.
They're still $40 wholesale from Zev.
That's crazy.
And they're still, that means that they're 30 bucks, 20, 30 bucks out of the cellar, and they're $1,200. And Kenjiro's not getting rich off it. Zev's not getting rich off it. And
same thing with Burgundy.
We do a year long. But it's interesting to watch it happen to these wines because they've been accepted by the same guy that 4 years ago was using his hedge fund money to buy Cristal, Krug, DRC.
So I was going to ask you, the influencer is not even an influencer. It's just a guy. He is an influencer, but he got a lot of followers. It's a hedge fund guy.
I assume so.
It's Democratic.
From the collector end of it, it is a lot of people posting photos of their bottles with corks still in them.
Right.
It's not like I drank this. It's like, look what I have access to. And I totally get it. Well, but it's like I'm not interested in car collecting either.
A drinker mentality. It's a collector mentality.
Exactly.
It's a show. Yeah.
And even when I was like a hardcore record collector, I still wanted you to come over to my house and listen to these songs.
Right.
And I still wanted to just talk to you for hours I used to say all the time, it's like being obsessed with Stevie Wonder but not being able to hear any of his music. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I get it. Again, I get it. Like, we all have bucket list things we want to check off and things that we want to be able to drink. And I'm very lucky to have come from an era of this stuff where I was able to drink all that stuff. I've had all kinds of crazy things that people have put in front of me, which I'm very fortunate, and distributors that want to sell them to me. But I don't feel comfortable putting those wines on the list for $1,200. And I don't feel – but
it's not you. It's
not the place. Put it on for $200, you know what happens? That hedge fund guy comes in three nights in a row.
I know. Wrong people.
Or they send their friends in. And then they clean you out. It's in like – and you don't want to have a culture in a restaurant of no. You don't want to have a thing where you're just so this person has it on their table and someone else says, can I have that? And you're like, oh, no. You don't want to do that.
Well, we'll talk about that when we talk about the restaurant and wine list.
Because it's just bad hospitality.
You're very keen to that, secret wine list and all that BS. It's funny. You said you were lucky through the years to taste a lot of stuff that now, maybe an Instagram post or whatever. Is there anything now? I mean, you still love and learn new things? I mean, what's anything notable right now, whether it's region, maker, type of wine, varietal?
There seems to be outside of just talking about winemakers, really, there seems to be a lot going on in Alsace again with really young people, which I think is interesting. I was talking to Steven Bitterhoff from Von Boden the other day.
I know, he's been on the show.
And I'm really inspired by what he's doing, and I'm really trying to learn more and get more into those places because
Robert and source material.
Yeah, sure. I think what they're doing is really interesting.
It's kind of organic.
Yeah, they're finding cool stuff, but the thing is like Steven was telling me that at this point vines in the Mosel are practically free. you can go there and start. And I think he thinks that there's going to be a lot more young energy in places like that because you can get started there really, really inexpensively because people are just dying out and they haven't wanted to work there. It's hard to work
and
there.
And the land doesn't,
yeah,
you know, get the type of...
I don't know. Wow. I mean, that's a really good question. I haven't visited.
So, I mean, if somebody dies in Napa, it's like a half a million acre.
It used to be that way in Languedoc, and I'm sure it still is, but people were finding 100-year-old ungrafted vines that have been abandoned for 20 years, and you can buy a hectare for $3,000. You know what I mean? Like, I think one of the things they've been highlighting
is they're starting to show younger guys making wine.
So that's, I think that's neat.
Or a younger guy with his dad, you know, new property or something.
So there's a lot of interesting things going on in those places and a ton of wines I've never seen before. And that's always fun. And tasting first vintage, second vintage, third vintage wines, that's always really neat.
But you brought up Steve, and that's where the distributors do the work and expose you. I mean, they still come in with stuff you've never heard of or tasted.
Time. It's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that's the fun part of that's really the thing that keeps you in it too. Like you get frustrated because you spend like 20 minutes on Instagram and it's just all this, and then you get out of it and like, you know, a wine rep comes in with just a great bag of stuff and you're like, okay, this is cool. Like, we don't have to worry about that.
I like to hear that. When we talk about natural wine, and I put it in quotes because I don't love the idea, but that type of wine is something you've been involved with and attracted to. I mean, what's the attraction? Is it the story, small producers? Is it taste?
I don't, the aesthetics.
But is the taste because they're not screwing around with the land?
I never made wine. You know what I mean? So I see a parallel through all these things, and I feel like these are the wines that I believe in.
So you don't sift through all of that. Now regenerative farming is, you know, a bigger thing than another thing besides biodynamics. There's permaculture. There's biodiversity.
I'll be honest.
You don't buy wines or get caught up.
I'll be completely honest. Whatever. I'm just not an academic about it. I'm just not an MW kind of person. I'm not a class person. I'm an experiential at the table. I'm a drinker. I like wines. I like traveling. I like meeting people that make them. I've been a pretty decent at, like, you know, tasting things that I think taste good and getting people excited about them. But the back end story of it isn't my story for wine. And I'm really happy that people teach me those things, but that's not really where I'm coming from.
I think what you described is really the best way to do it versus studying books for six.
Depends. I mean, there are people I know that, like, you know, there are people who that comes very second nature to, and their way of enjoying something is knowing everything about it. And I'm not, I just don't need to be there. It's just not for me. And it's not because I'm lazy either. Right. It's just that that's not like, I don't need to know the science behind it. You know, I mean, I do see that like things that I really love and things that I'm interested in selling happen to be part of this culture and happen to be made this way from what I've learned and been told. But these are the wines I like. And those are the wines I'm shown. And that's the stuff I go to, you know. And I have found that, like, when I drink wines that aren't that way, I just don't really enjoy them. And it's obvious. It's not even I really like that till I found out that they spray or whatever. Right. It's just like the spraying is just part of an entire equation. It starts there and it goes farther.
It's not for me.
Yeah. But I also know people that like mousy wine. You know, I know people who can't taste VA. Like, I'm not that person either. Like, I don't like those wines either. I make no excuse for that stuff. I can't taste through those issues. I can't be like, well, this really VA'd wine is still cool because the guy who makes it, this is their story.
Right.
I'd be like, oh, it just didn't work out this year. Maybe next year will be better.
I think that's a real and fair way to look at it. All right, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Justin Cherno. Justin is the wine guy and partner at the Four Horsemen, a restaurant and wine bar. In Brooklyn. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little more about, you know, Four Horsemen and his wine list and some of the other things. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House.
Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Justin Cherno. Justin from the Four Horsemen in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Justin, you've been here, what, 7, 8 years?
June will be 7 years.
Which is, I mean, admirable and not an easy thing, right?
It feels like it went from like 3 to 7. I can't figure it out.
I know.
It's like having kids.
And, you know, every show I've done for the past few years has, you know, been a pandemic thing. But the good news is that we're here, you're here, and we look forward. So there should be a cool story here. And the question is, how did the Four Horsemen come about? You know, sure. I know we'll get to James Murphy in a minute, but I know that he either produced or you knew him musically years before.
Yeah, he did.
So give me this story.
He was referred when I was in the band Turing Machine. We had self-recorded an album in our rehearsal space on an 8-track, and we needed someone to produce and mix it. And he was referred to us by friends, and I went to his studio with the CD of, you know, back when you burn CDs. That's right. A compact disc for all the young CDs. Listeners.
Yeah.
And I brought it to him, and we started talking in the studio in the afternoon. And we ended up listening to music, not the music I brought, but ended up listening to records all day and spent some time together and laughed and like, oh, wow, we like a lot of the same stuff. And he was like, have you heard this? Have you heard this? Have you heard this? And then we started emailing each other back and forth, and it was a couple of weeks, and he's like, okay, yeah, we'll mix the record, come in on this day. And we came in, and he and his studio partner loaded the CD that I gave him into the CD player, and it was the first time they ever heard it. Because he was like, well, you liked cool music. I figured, how bad could your band be? And then we became really good friends from there on. And wow. I thought that was pretty funny. And
what year do you remember?
98, yeah. And then so over time, as he saw once he got in his 30s, he started the band. They started to become very successful and travel a lot. And then I was traveling for wine, so we'd sometimes end up in some similar cities together in France or something like that. And we'd go eat, and we'd hang out. And then he started going other places and being like, oh, this place I went to in Japan reminds me of this place that you took me to there or this. We started talking about that. That he met and married his now wife, Christina, who was from Denmark, but at the time she lived in London. And then Randy, our other partner, who they met when they were in Los Angeles, also liked all these places. And we all sort of started becoming dinner friends, wine friends. And were you
the most evolved wine guy?
For wine, yeah. Because it was my job, but everybody else, you know,
right. No, because
but,
of that.
But we all liked to really spend time together, and everybody had their own interests, and we all showed and shared things to each other that none of us had seen before. We were like, man, I wish we had a place like all these other places that we loved. And the great thing is, none of us had all shared the same favorite place. We all had different places that we loved and different aspects of that. And I really wish we had something like this here. And that's sort of when, you know, we decided that wouldn't it be great if we did something like this in New York.
And from that thought to reality, was that quick or
it was about 2 years, I think it was.
And is it 2 years of regular discussion or on and off?
No, I mean, I still, you know, James was busy in his band. Christina and Randy were busy in their careers. And I worked with Zev Rovine at the time, so I was doing that. And
right,
I
had we just, didn't talk about that.
And I just had a kid. So we all had things going on, but we all, you know, would come together to work on this as well. And so it was, it was just a lot of meetings, emails, you know, that kind of stuff. And everybody kind of had their own responsibilities, and we sort of did it as a team.
Isn't one of the tougher things, like, a location?
It is.
Like, I'm sure you weren't looking at locations.
This was the only
2 days
this was
after
actually the- was the only location. James happens to live next door. And this was a vegan fast food takeout place called Food Swings. And then the space we're sitting in now that is Night Moves was a bar called Larry Lawrence that had been here for some time. And Food Swings lease was over. And James had become friendly with the landlord of this building who lived upstairs. And they had said, you know, well, someday when Food Swings is done, you know, we'd love to maybe open a place in there in 5 or 6 years. And the landlord said, well, their lease is done.
Wow.
And that was it. It was just, it was time. We signed the lease and we just went for it.
Right away.
I mean, pretty much.
Said that, you had to jump right in.
Pretty much that was it.
Where were you living then?
I live in Greenpoint.
So it was Greenpoint, same place as it is now.
Which is also a much different neighborhood 7 years later than it was 21 years ago when I moved there.
My kid lived there maybe 8-10 years ago. I mean, I should have bought everything in sight. There were 7 restaurants. There's like 70 now.
Yeah, it's true.
Ridiculous.
It's crazy.
You know, it's like, I'm sure Williamsburg. I'm not sure. Williamsburg was like that. All right. So you sign a lease. And now what? It's like, I signed a lease. Are we doing what we said or what are we doing? I mean, how do you pull this? What's the mission? What's the vision?
The vision was a small place that people could come to and drink the wines that we love that served, you know, fresh, bright, like kind of like just the kind of food that we thought worked with the wine that we liked, but with like a real team in the kitchen that really believed in what they wanted to do and really felt like they had some freedom and then hire a front of house person, manager who knew how to run a restaurant because none of us had even worked in a restaurant
before. So the flow is right.
Pardon me?
So the flow, yes, exactly, you know, so exactly, the front exactly. of the room's working.
Yeah, so because that has to be spot on.
So I don't know if we talked off here or on here, but you didn't want to open a wine restaurant. You didn't want to open a wine bar. You didn't want to open a restaurant. You wanted to do both.
Well, that's because the places that we loved often were also wine stores within the restaurant. But the places that we really liked, I don't know if we discussed this or not, but we made this huge mistake when we opened. When we spoke years ago, I might not have known it was a mistake yet. but we had referred to our place as a wine bar. And
maybe
in New York, people think that's bar veloce. You know, you get some burrata and you get some prosciutto. And then you sit at the bar. And we literally, for the first year we were open, we had people we were the first place in Williamsburg to take reservations. And people were pissed about it. And they thought we were really elitist. And even wine people I knew were like, oh, I guess that means I can never go there because I can't spontaneously go there.
Right.
You know?
That's interesting.
And it was a real backlash against it. People saw it as pretty elitist and almost like we were opening a velvet rope restaurant where like we were going to decide that wasn't the case at all. We just don't have a lot of seats and we want to know how to buy food. And because James and Christina and I, and now Randy as well, we're parents. We needed to know if we wanted to go somewhere that we love, that we can go there. We had grown up going to Diner and Marlowe and Sons and places that had taken great care of us. But if you showed up there at 7:30 on a Saturday night and say you had a babysitter, you might not sit till 9:00. And then you're done. You have to go home. So we wanted to make a place that people knew that what part of their night it was as well. That was why we took reservations.
And that blew over. I mean, everybody.
Yeah, it blew over. But because we said we were a wine bar and we meant like Vervalet or La Dauphine or a hero store in Japan or somewhere, these places that we used to love and still love very much.
Those were inspirations.
Yeah, but like we thought that meant people understood that they were there for dinner and they were going to drink wine and they'd make a reservation and eat soppressata. You know what I mean? And so we had to really – we spent a long time, a couple of years in the press explaining to people that the term wine bar doesn't apply to us. We just happen to have a bar where you drink wine. And now that we're so booked, it's kind of sucks, but like we're so booked that we don't really have that business anymore where people can just roll in and have a glass at the bar.
No.
Because people book to eat at the bar. This is a neighborhood.
Yeah. You can't have everything.
Yeah, I know. It's true. I mean, we're lucky. But
let's – let's talk about the food first,
sure.
And then we'll morph into the wine. I wouldn't say you got lucky, but I'd say that you got the right guy. I mean, your chef, Nick Curatola.
Curatola.
Mm-hmm. Has been with you how long?
Since actually for a year before we opened.
Okay.
Maybe even a little longer than that.
So he's part of the family.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a couple things, correct me if I'm wrong. He received a Michelin star.
That's correct.
Current.
Yep, we're on our second year. We're, okay. You know, hopefully we go for third. We'll see.
And I don't don't think it's a secret he's writing or a cookbook's coming out.
Yep. We're working on a Four Horsemen cookbook that is Nick's. I'm doing the wine content and Nick is obviously doing all the food content. There'll be some stuff about the restaurant, things like that.
Oh, nice.
So but, there'll be a but, you wine. Know, we're trying to, you know, we're putting it all together.
So it's a...
It is a Nick Curtola Four Horsemen cookbook.
Okay.
And
so you
and
highlight Nick, but the Four Horsemen's prominent. That's nice.
There's a lot of food in it and it's not... It's important, and Nick and I spoke a lot about this, that we want the wine content and the food content to be something people can go back to. And it's not just pictures of, like, us in the restaurant. It is a usable book.
So a couple of questions, maybe more. Has Nick's cooking evolved into something a little different than what it was? When you do the wine list... Is there thought of what he's cooking or vice versa? He cooks what you're thinking, or to me, it would probably be collaborative.
The thing is we live in this contemporary small plates food kind of moment or whatever it is where I know that we've worked together long enough now. I know essentially what's coming out of the kitchen. And it's interesting because it's important to us that I think Nick says it, we're an international local restaurant. So we have Japanese flavors on the menu with European flavors on the menu with, you know, Eastern flavor, you know, like really all kinds of stuff together in your same meal and like classical American flavors. But the acidity's high, the products are good, the level of care and, you know, and work that goes into each dish is incredibly high. And the wine, because I like, you know, wine with good acidity and freshness, it lands next to the food.
So you pointed something out. The food has good acidity. A lot of people, when they talk about food, so what does that mean? Like citrus ingredients,
vinegars,
that point, right?
Bright vinegar. Because it seems to me like
and that,
that what they want, what they have to hit the table, they really want to pop. You know,
so foods like that are complemented by high acidic foods. They don't fight.
Depends. It depends. And thankfully, we do have a team that understands how to put that stuff on the table, but you might have multiple moments through your meal where, you have to think about it, you know?
But that's cool, too.
Yeah, it is.
It's challenging to your palate and
absolutely.
All of that.
I mean, yeah, you know, there's always, asparagus and, you know, cardoons and things like that that are always a challenge.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, also, everywhere I go puts that – every single place I know that's wine focused still puts that stuff on the table.
Is cardoons tougher than asparagus to pair?
I don't know. It could be, you know, it's like I just always put that in artichoke land, you know what I mean? So
cardoons, asparagus, and artichokes. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the wine list.
Sure.
One of the interesting things is a lot of restaurants post their wine list. I kind of know why you don't.
Well.
Because it changes.
It changes, but also we're getting back into posting it now. We're
going
to start doing that again. Funny you say that. But I don't tend to post a lot of pictures of wine.
No, you don't.
I mean, I do on my private
socials
and stuff like that.
I'm talking about the website and just saying, what's this guy got on his list?
I don't know. I mean, it's like we all – the thing is in New York, for the most part, we all are offered the same wines. You have the same sales rec, the same companies. It's not like I am direct importing all this stuff and it's all mine. You know, you have your relationships and maybe you're offered a little more of this or that or things like that. Yeah, allotments
or
allocations are better
or
it's important to a distributor to have their wine on your list or whatever. And sometimes we're really lucky to be on the positive side of that. And that's great. But it is a lot of this stuff is in the challenge of not just it's not being ubiquitous. You know, it's like everybody knows what wines are famous. Everybody knows these things. And so it's not like if we post our wine list at a bunch of restaurants are just going to buy those wines because everybody has them offered to them anyway. And it's all out there. It's all you just get your Jenny Francois, your Dresner book, your Grand Cru Selections book, your Kermit Lynch, all the wines there to buy. It's just, do you make that decision? If for some reason we were really fortunate enough to be in a category where people wanted to look at our list and be influenced by buying those wines, it's kind of great because then it's good for the distributor and the grower.
Yeah.
A lot of wines we represent that I like to put on I mentioned this wine last time, I think, when we were on the air, Domaine Lamboral. It's a wine through Kermit Lynch. The wine was, I think, represented by IPO. They don't have the same reach as a lot in this contemporary market as a lot of the younger distributors. Baral is top 10, you know, real natural wines of the world.
Right.
You could buy it on any great list of the world. But you don't see it anywhere in New York. because it was with the wrong distributor and they just didn't get it into the right restaurants and it wasn't a priority to them to sell it.
And the market wasn't either smart enough or aware where they wouldn't bug guys like you and say, how come this is...
Karen Yon and Syrah from the Languedoc. It's like, it's not necessarily en vogue, but it's a really important wine. And when it hits the table and people have it in front of them, they're like, this is a great wine. Right. So there, it's
you're not being too nerdy about it. I mean, you're right about this.
You know, yeah,
it was an oversight that New York, just, and it was mechanics, the distributors. Well, they didn't push it.
I worked for I worked with Zev.
Yeah, sure.
I worked for Zev for 6 years, and like, it was fascinating to watch wines that were with another book end up being like, you know, I'm not selling enough wine with them. I'd like to work with you, and then they would move to his book, and then the wine in a year would be allocated. But it was on closeout with the other distributor,
right,
and vice versa. Wines that he and I believed in more than anything, really loved. You know, I can't even think of them, but I remember these moments. And then they're like, and I'm sorry, you guys aren't selling enough. I'm going to this distributor. And then they become just allocated with that distributor. It just depends the context of the wine and how people get out and sell them and how they believe in them. It happens on our list here too. There are wines that I can't believe we were lucky enough to get, and I just didn't take the time to really talk to our team about it, or it didn't land with them in a way that they really believed. They sit there, you know? And it's like, and I go to Paris or somewhere, and every restaurant I go to, somebody pulls a bottle out, like, dude, have you had this yet? You're gonna love this. And
I was
like,
I got a case of
it sitting in the basement in New York. Exactly.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
How much does you know, like you said, everything's reservation now, and I'm sure you have reoccurring guests and you have neighborhood guests and all of that. How much of the list is dictated by the consumer, the customer? Like if, and again, I don't want to peg it as natural wine, but if your list is composed of certain types of wines and people just want, you know, a Northern Rhone or something, carrying that or how do you handle that?
I mean,
what
we do is it ebbs and flows. There are tons of times I look at the list and say, whoops, we don't have a Cote de Rhone. Or whoops, like I need to get more Riesling or whatever, because things ebb and flow and you only have so much money to spend a month. And also when you when there are wines that you love and you get offered them once a year and they sell out, it's like another, you have to find a new wine. You know what I mean? You have to find a new thing to put in that slot. And I don't want to fill the list yearly with lesser things. I want to fill them with things that I believe in and that we love. So I'm trying actually to stay a little more on that this year and maybe even think about, you know, I think we're at 840 wines on the list right now and 30 seats. I'd like to really maybe shrink the list down and make it just a bit more producer and region focused, a little bit, but still introducing wines from new people that we love.
So why is it? Why is it 840 and why does it have to be maybe tightened up a little? Is that exuberance on your part? Is that having stuff you want? Is that the answer to my question? This is stuff the consumer wants? Or
I don't know. It's like for stuff the consumer wants, I think of texture and I think of size mostly. So for consumer wants, yeah. I mean, yeah, sure, there are people that come in here and they're like, do you have, you know, Julien Le Bay, or do you have Pacolet, or do you have Cornelison, or, you know, the big names, things that are identifiable, you know, Patrick Beaujeu or whatever, like, do you have these things? And we're going to have it. Like, I also, like, that's another reason why I don't put the list online or wasn't putting in, because it's kind of inferred that we're going to have that stuff.
Right.
It's the stuff that you don't know that might be more interesting to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of you in this place and people, if they're open-minded.
Yeah. If they're open-minded, exactly.
And if you need a little zooger push, maybe you'll be turned on to the next big thing.
Exactly.
And
you should be drinking this because this is, yeah. But
What happens? Mm-hmm. So you get a wine you love and, you know, it's highly allocated and popular. I mean, for financial reasons, do you just sell it to get your money back or do you try to slot it?
How highly
like you
allocated.
Said about the Wall Street guy, you don't want him to send his three friends in and clear you out.
I still have my Miroir and the last couple of Auvergne drops and some other things like that in storage.
Really?
Because I'm waiting for the first of all, I don't think they're ready on release.
Okay.
So that's the first thing.
Patience.
And so I don't think they're ready on release. But I also think I want to see if the market levels out on some of this stuff and maybe we can get them back to a point where we can really sell them in a way that we're comfortable again, and the wines will be great. But if we're going to have to sell them for just a stupid amount of money because that's their value and we have to stay open, I want the wine to be profoundly in place and beautiful and ready rather than just being like, I mean, because, dude, the minute that's a lot of that stuff comes out and somebody puts it on social media, people come in and they're I heard Overwatch allocations drop this week. What do you have?
But it's fair to do it either way. If you do it because you can for the money or you want to hold it to see.
It's hard because I do think in some ways you have a contract.
You're thinking about it.
But you also have a contract with the grower in your emotionally and with your distributor. And in a lot of ways, it's not fair to your distributor to have to put that wine on for $800 and $900. But even Chambers is selling Overmore for $500 now.
Jesus.
You know what I mean?
That's like an ouch.
I mean, and to me, that's like, it doesn't get to be a tighter relationship with Dresdner than them. And so I look to them as a benchmark. God. I mean, you know, I see those wines on Sompix or other places like that for $6, $7, $8. You know, it's like, and then they're gone, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there'll always be a market.
Yeah.
Clojard, all that stuff.
But Rougeard, we sold two or three bottles of Rougeard this weekend for the first time in a long time. And there were 11s and 12s of the Poyou, I think it was. Somebody saw it on some tape. You know, it's on the list, but somebody saw it and they're like, oh, wow, you have that. I'll drink that. I didn't think about it, but that's really what I want. And it sold.
That's crazy.
I think I sell those for a little under market because people don't really come to Four Horsemen to drink Rougeard.
So you do the right thing.
I mean, it's still, to be honest, still market rate, but it's slightly below. It's less than what the Modern sells it for or places like that.
I would hope and expect that you can get a little better value here than the Modern.
Yeah, it just depends.
For whatever reason. Yeah. But there's no guarantee to that. I should know the answer to this, but are you doing by the glass?
Oh, yeah. We do two sparkling, four or five reds, two oranges, four or five whites, and then four sweet wines every day.
What – how much does that change frequently?
In order to put things that we really like by the glass, we have to order it in volume so then we get a discounted price. But I tend to do each wine about 3 to 5 cases and then move on immediately. We have enough regulars and we're lucky enough to have regulars that order by the glass. And I like that to be always moving. And for our front of house team to always have something new. Also, a lot of wine you don't get more than 3 cases of, you know?
But to that point, don't you have to look at by the glass differently because you need volume? So there's certain things.
There's no – again, I've done this now for 20 years. There has never been a time where there's been – even though everything's freaking allocated, there's never been – more wine in the market than there is right now. This kind of wine. I'm sure there was tons of Napa Cab and lower end stuff where they had massive yields and stuff before I was into wine or even when I was just getting into wine. But for small producer wine, it's all coming in here at a breakneck pace. And if anything, I can't keep up. I have to make decisions now and be like, man, I really love this winery and it's going to be sold out in 3 weeks, but I just bought this one. So I guess I'll wait till the next drop. You know, because it's just going to be
gone.
Does
that usually work out or like?
It always works out because there's always something else to drink.
Yeah.
The fact that I didn't get 36 bottles of some wine from Croatia does not keep me up at night. There's always something else, you know. And there is
always something else and that's the healthy way to look at
it. Yeah. I think that's the fun part.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have, my feelings aren't going to get hurt. If we don't get offered something, or I'm not going to call somebody, you know, people do it, but I'm not going to call a distributor begging that I've ordered from twice this year because they got a very allocated champagne in, and I feel like I deserve it, even though I've shown their company zero support. That's not how you do business.
What about the opposite way? Do distributors come to you? And I think those days are gone where they have a wine where I need you to take this to have it on your list or even for me to go back to my boss and say,
I've definitely been approached by people that do that, but they also know that's not really going to work because it's just not how – that's not like –
they're not
that's
carrying not, crappy wine.
It's also not the way like we work together. They know that I'm not the wrong guy for that, people still do that, but not like when I was in retail. Like, you know, you floor stack all this Sauvignon Blanc, I'll get you Van Winkle. You know what I mean? That's like, that doesn't happen.
For two bottles of Van
Winkle. Exactly.
That's crazy. Yeah. All right. So that's the Four Horsemen. And it's probably one of the great combinations of incredibly thoughtful food and obviously, you know, a thoughtful wine list. All right, so we got to wrap up the show, but I want to do two things. I want you to do the wine list.
Okay. It'll
take a few minutes, and I want to taste this wine, and I want you to talk me through it.
Sure.
But a couple things I wanted to mention. It's funny and actually very nice, and we talked about it off air. I mean, James Murphy's one of your apartments, one of your partners. He's on Saturday Night Live.
That's true.
This week, so let's give him a plug. And it's very cool for him and cool for Saturday night. We talked about it.
I hope that most of the people my age or that are listening to this stay
are awake.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, DVR now.
That's true.
You don't
have
to worry about it. All right, so here's the last question before we do those two things. All right, you're now a middle-aged guy.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get away from it. You are a middle-aged guy. You crossed the half-century thing. All right, you have to pick one profession, musician or wine guy. Now, your buddy James got to do both.
It's
not
true.
Necessarily
true.
You.
True.
What still burns hotter in you?
Oh, man, I just think – I would not want to be my age and on the road and on stage.
So you're happy where you are?
I like where I'm at. I think you can.
I think you're right.
I could be 70 years old and still ordering these wines and sitting at dinner and eating and flying around and doing stuff like that. But nobody wants to see me do that
on stage. I think you're right. And I think James sort of is the exception. He has this cool shtick where he's no kid. He's got this. Yeah. He kind of does what he wants. Wait, did I say no kids?
Yeah, you did.
No kids. What did I forget? But he doesn't have to worry about, other things.
Right.
But he does it the way he wants.
Yeah,
it's he's and the last thing. I'm not even going to say this because it'll get you in trouble. I'll tell you off air what the joke is. All right. So before we leave, we're going to do the wine list and we're going to taste this wine. So let's do the wine list.
Okay,
everyone gets subjected to the wine list. Five questions. Same five questions to everyone. Done over 200 of these.
Cool.
We post them. I will post these on our social media. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What are you tasting? What's in your fridge at home? What's interesting you? Could be for work, could be personal.
Sure. I'm really liking, from a general perspective, really in the last 2 years, especially, I've really gotten into the wines that Jeffrey Alpert brings in.
Alpert. B or P?
P. I really think that his palate and the wines that he's working with are really exceptional and broad. And for someone like, he started bringing in Ganavot early. And he's also a second career wine person. He was a printer. He ran a very large printing
importer?
Business. He's an importer.
Okay. And his portfolio, your sensibilities.
His portfolio is stunning. And
he's the Ganavot guy?
In a lot of ways edgier than even some of my taste, and he's older. And I think he's a really interesting guy, and his palate's spot on, and he's really fun to drink with. And but he's doing a lot of work in Savoie that I like.
Okay.
And he works
with producers.
Giacchino, I like quite a lot. They're younger, but great wine. They make a white called Monferina that I've glassed here that I really like. He's just stuff from that part of France. That's kind of stuff I love having on the list here, and like opening on Tuesday night. You know what I mean? Those are kind of wines I really like.
I'm surprised that I haven't heard Jeffrey come up more.
Yeah,
so it's
nice. Really
it's
incredible,
nice to hear
incredible
from him.
Importer.
All right, we'll take that as a great answer. This is the goofiest question on the list, but we ask you your favorite wine and food pairing, not what you think is good or what do you
–
Knishes and Sauvignon, whatever.
No, I have
Go ahead.
One. It's I'm sure everybody says Comte and Vinjean, but I'm not going to say that.
Well, they don't, but you're not allowed to say champagne and oysters, is Comte and Vinjean.
It is champagne and really dry aged steak.
Is that your choice?
Yes.
All right, I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
So I hope, like me, you're a big champagne fan, just a great, beverage anytime, anything. So dry aged, probably if you looked up, the database – probably everyone is a Bordeaux or an Apicat.
Sure, sure, sure.
Why does that work with?
Think about.
So dry age, let me set up here, is funkier.
Yeah.
It could be a minimum of 25 days, could be 60, 70.
Yeah.
Dries, the flavors are more intense. It smells and tastes different.
Think about champagne and blue cheese or things like that. That is, it really has that thing where you have this like almost lactic bacteria and all this stuff, and you have this acidic, bright, and especially slightly oxidative aged champagne. It is hands down my favorite wine
I've never,
and food pairing.
I've had steak and champagne, but I've never done it where it's like a session. So now I got to do that.
It's awesome.
But life is too short to have a crappy steak and bad champagne. Right. So when you do this, good champagne.
Exactly.
Good butcher steak. Exactly. All right. So that's a good one. That, I think, may be a first time, too, on the show, which I like. All right. I know you have a kid. I know you're getting old. I know you're married. I know you're very busy at work. But if I asked you your favorite wine restaurant and or bar, can you answer that? And I want to set this up. By mentioning people doesn't mean you left anyone out. Okay. By mentioning it's not necessarily your favorite. What I want to get from you is, who doesn't like this place? Who cares about the wine, cares about the food? The vibe is good. You educate your people. So you come in here and you go, wow, that was cool. Who's doing stuff like that that you like?
I really like it's actually – there are French expats in New York. But there's there's always these like – obviously other places that everybody says that are good. But I really like what Pierre over at Fougueron's is doing in Greenpoint.
Fairly new, right?
Yeah, but really, really smart list, really deep, great – great psalm and really personable and delicious wines and not afraid to take risks. I like what Clement is doing over at Fredai. He's one of the owners. He's like, they're just getting started. They've been on a shoestring. They had to go through COVID.
Didn't he bring the guy from Daniel Balut over?
No, he's got the
Smedley.
No, the guys he's got over there were at Septime in Paris.
Oh, okay.
And then they're very good, but they're American guys. And then I really like what Pierre's doing at Ernesto's as well. Like really like started with mostly Spanish stuff, but now doing his thing and has been in the biz and was one of my favorite psalms when he was in Paris, when he was at Bones in a clown bar. He's really smart.
He's got good chops.
Those guys have good chops and they're all three people that are really enjoying being able to buy the wines that they couldn't buy where they started. So their minds are being blown by like, you know, Italian wines and American wines and Central European wines and all the stuff that we have in this market in spades that they couldn't drink before. So they're not just like, this is what was cool in Paris or whatever. It's like, I love wine again and I really love being on the floor and I'm going to give you real service.
I think that's one of the great restaurants in New York. I mean, I think it's got all the critical acclaim and the place is incredible. And thank God people just don't talk about it all the time or obsess over it like other restaurants. It's in a crazy neighborhood way east, you know. But so those are good ones. All right, fourth question. Favorite all-time wine, the original question. And probably when I asked you this originally, I was fishing for, hey, you're a wine guy. What's the most expensive rare wine you ever drank? I don't give a crap about that.
Yeah, yeah, I understand.
And now that everyone's listened to the show, the answer, you know, is even more telling and it'll be interesting. What's that wine that one or two wines important to you, whether it was a gateway, enlightened you, changed the way you thought? You know, what's that wine?
It's at one point it was a very gettable wine, and now it's not gettable at all, and it's worth a gazillion dollars. But it is a winemaker in Loire named Xavier Caillard. I'll send you the spelling of his name.
Okay.
He had a winery called Jardin Esmeraldin. The wines were aged, I think, for 10 years in the barrel before release. That sounds about right. The wines were they had a blip in like being cool, maybe. In France like a decade ago, but they were wines people put in your table. I had bought some in Europe and we had them, even had them on the list here. There's some bottles hanging. There's one up here somewhere.
Empty bottle.
But they were really important to me, but it was a Chenin and it was a very emotional, touching wine. It was before it was hard to get. It was special and it was small, but
genuine.
It affected me very, very deeply. It was a 2000 white, 2000 Chenin, and it was a really profoundly personal and amazing wine. And then, of course, it turns out he never really made any money because of the way he aged the wine, and there wasn't enough wine to make to survive, I think. And he sold the winery and I think retired or whatever at a young age and went on something. It was kind of like a failure, I think, in a lot of ways. The wine was really incredible, and you know, you'll never ever. I think I saw a bottle for like $1,800 on Sawpix or something like that. And we were buying it for like $30 or $40, you know, back in the day. Like,
now, because that wine, does that make Chenin one of your favorite whites, or you just have to isolate it to that situation?
I mean, I like Chenin Blanc, I like Chenin Blanc a lot just as much as anybody, but the Chenin Blanc is a really wonderfully complex grape because sometimes I like it. Sometimes I think it's too acidic. Some winemakers, it's unfinished. It's not like you just put one in front of me and I'm going to have this moment. Like, right. I think it's a great, I think it's a great wine, but every single wine depends on the grower. There's tons of Syrah I probably would find undrinkable, but I love Jean-Michel Stéphan and Darden Ribot and Versailles and things like that. You know what I mean?
All good ones. All right. So that's a good one. And always the story is better than the wine sometimes.
Yeah,
why, you know,
totally.
I love that.
I probably will never see it again, which is also
a whole other thing. Yeah, that's sad. Yeah. And it's even like you talk about Auvergne and even some of the other, which is just ridiculous and hard to get. Mm-hmm. This is impossible to get.
I mean, I'm sure it's possible.
But as time goes by, it's less and less. So that's a little sad. All right. You should be able to handle this question. Because you were a retailer and you are a restaurateur. So I want you to recommend the best wine around $15, $20, $22 retail. I want you to recommend a red and a white. You can do category, like I bet you agree with me, Muscadet is a pretty good value for the money. But so you could do that. I would love to hear specific makers. The setup's always been my kids are in their mid-late 20s. They can't show up at parties or gift $12 wines anymore,
right, sure.
But they can't afford 40, 50. So how do you wow for 18, 22, 15? Tell me what you're thinking, red, white.
I remember what I said last time, so I'll do two
you
different
do?
Wines this time.
I think you listened to the show.
I did not listen to the show because I wanted to make sure that like we were in this. I don't think I've even done any interviews.
I'll go back and compare. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking, I mean – it's funny, but I really do think if you could get at this point for white, if you could get something from the Savoie,
okay,
in that price range, like
I think they're there,
fresh like Altesse, Jacquere, something like that from that region. The wines really have that alpine mineral water and freshness, and they're not anonymous. It's not like showing up with Pinot Grigio or something. They have a personality and they taste like their place, and it's cool. And it would make somebody be like, well, what's this?
Right, they're interesting.
Yeah.
So Savoir whites, mm-hmm. Altesse, Jacquard, good.
For reds, I mean, currently, because funny because everything's so expensive.
Is red tougher?
Red's tougher because you know, like the things that have maintained being low priced are not not that great. But Côte de Rhône is always still like a real value from like a good grower, like Roche-Buissière or somebody like that, like. There's some weight there. I think when people show up with a red wine, you want it to have a little, especially if they're not wine people, they want it to have a little depth. You don't want to show up with like a super carbonic, like fun little glue wine.
If you're playing to the crowd, you're 100% right. But if you're with your buddies, you do all of that.
But I mean, I still think the value's there and there's tons of natural growers and people doing wine that's really beautiful. And they're like, you know, get something that's like mostly Syrah and Grenache and it's going to have some depth and you're going to feel like something's in your glass and it'll be easier to drink than you think.
Those are good ones, and I think you're within that range. All right, like I said earlier, we post your answers on our social media. We'll probably start kicking up everything tomorrow.
Cool.
All right, last segment of the show, weekly wine sip, when I have the opportunity, usually with a winemaker or you know somebody who has wine close to them, I ask them to select a bottle to taste. The more important thing is that it reflects the type of wines at the restaurant and what you like and that it's accessible, kind of cool and all that. So tell me what we're drinking.
So this is a wine called Mega Mix by Julien Guillot.
Okay. And Guillot, I want to just spell it for everybody. It's G-U-I-L-L-O-T, Julien Guillot.
A winemaker in the Mâcon.
His
family took over the domain like 1954, I think. But the domain has a history of making wine back about 1,200 years, like really, really old. It was a medieval domain. The clothes around some of the vineyards and stuff are really old, you know, like medieval stone, like ancient stone walls. His grandfather started the domain and was really, really like, I'm not scared, but like really didn't want to use any pesticides or poisons. He really considered them poisons. So there's been no spraying or anything like that in the domain.
They didn't have to bring it back. No, it was never there.
And it's fairly for where it is, like the winery, I've been there, it's fairly large, you know, comparatively, but it's not like industrial by any means. It's just, he has space.
Right.
And he works in these really, really big old barrels. And this wine is called Mega Mix. I think last year might have been the first year he made it. I think it's the second vintage. It's just equal parts Pinot, Chardonnay, and Gamay, all from his vines. It's just a lot of fun. That label is like ridiculous, but nothing, everything else he does is very traditional calligraphy.
Right, it is like, kind beautiful, of a funky label.
But, like, this is kind of a, but I think this is a great entry-level wine for him.
And what's the retail about on this?
I'm not sure. I bet the retail's probably around $30. Okay. 30 something. I think it's like
so
20,
it's a killer wine for $30.
Yeah, I think it's a blast.
Interesting, delicious, great blend.
And it really does. It opens a bit reductive, but it really does open
all right,
and integrate.
So let's do a quick evaluation. Yeah, cool. On the color. What's that color? How do you describe that?
I mean, for lack of a better word, wouldn't you kind of call it burgundy?
Like, yeah, it's like a translucent, you know, red, a burgundy-ish, not a deep one, not a super light one.
Right.
All right, nose, tell me what you get descriptors on the nose. I suck at this.
For me, it's like, these are my things, but I get like strawberry seeds, like a little, there's a little sour fruit, you smell a little acidity, but there's a tiny bit of reduction, but the palate of the wine pushes through all that.
All right, so we'll get to that. The mouthfeel, it's sort of a medium. It's not thin or light. It's not cloying. It's, you know, somewhere in medium negative. All right, does the palate reflect the nose? You were
no,
getting
I think
into that.
I think the palate is deeper, and there's almost like green fruit a little bit. It doesn't taste underripe, but they're like, it reminds me of like, there's like I said, like strawberry seeds, raspberry seeds. The palate to me is the opposite. It's like ripe strawberries, ripe cherries, riper, darker, more maroon kind of fruit. Like, and I really like that. But then you get some of that crunchy tannin and grip on the back of your tongue.
It's funny because one of the, not criticisms, but one of the biggest things people talk about to me is like, when people describe wine, what the hell are they talking about? And when you know, and you've had this wine and all that. But it's funny, like, of course people will pick up strawberry, that red fruit and all that. But there's, I don't know if the word's bitterness, but the seeds are somewhat prominent. So when you say strawberry seed, you're right. But, you know, people don't think that. So it's just, it's crazy in that sense. All right. So what wine pairing? What are typically?
I think for something like this, actually, for me, like we do, you know, for lunch on Friday, Saturday, Sunday here, we do this, we bake our own like really beautiful focaccia. It's kind of thick and airy. And then they do like a shaved, like a thinly sliced ham with some chilies and an aioli. I think that this would be amazing with that.
So it works with the bread. It works with the meat.
It
works
right through
the
fat and everything. Like, cut through that oil in the oil.
What kind of ham? Imported or American?
I'm not positive of what the ham they use is, to be honest. I haven't. I just eat the sandwich.
I think I may have to fire you.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Yeah.
All right. So that is, let me just read this out. That is there a vintage date on this?
I think this is 19.
All right. So let's say 19, the current Clos de Vin de Mainz. Julien Guillot, red table wine, and it's a blend of Gamay, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Camille Riviere. Let's give her a shout out. It's called Mega Mix. Definitely a delicious wine, good price point. Yeah. You know,
I think it's a lot of wine for that price.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a good one, and thank you for pulling that out. All right, Justin, we got to wrap it up. Let me do a quick wrap up, and let me get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's Sam at the Grape Nation. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. But subscribe, because then the show will show up. Follow us on Facebook at the Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at S Ben Ruby. On Twitter, we're at Ben Ruby. Confusing, but you can always use the hashtag the Grape Nation to get to that. As I mentioned, we will post Justin's wine list, some great, you know, recos there. And I will post info on our weekly wine sip. So if we wanted to find out more about you, if people say, hey, that sounds like a cool guy, can I follow him on social media? And I know that you're not the big, huge social media guy, but it's public. Yeah, so where can they find you?
It's, I guess, Instagram is Jay Cherno.
C-H-E-A-R-N-O.
It's mostly pictures of my kid. And my wife's artwork.
That's how I knew you were up in Beacon yesterday. Exactly. And then if we want more info on the Four Horsemen, just Google
just Four Horsemen BK, and then BK. And Instagram. We put we're getting back into that again.
The menu.
It felt like it was a bad taste the last 2 years to post anything, so we're getting back into it. But and you know, you can probably sign up for the mailing list on the website. We're trying to retool and all that stuff again too.
But I remember, I don't know if it was pre-COVID, but the menu would come out, you know, all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always a fun menu. I mean, that's how good the food is. And like you said earlier, all the different influences, whether it's Mediterranean, American, and all that. Thanks. I mean, the food's tremendous. All right. Thank you to our guest, Justin Cherno. Thanks to our engineers at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.